KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Famed pollster Richard Zogby joins us this hour to talk about the presidential race, the accuracy and methodology of polling, and a book he recently published on the transformation of the American dream. With your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. John Zogby, not Richard Zogby, but John Zogby, who describes himself as being a prognosticator as well as comparing himself to a priest and a philosopher, is president and CEO of Zogby International, a world-famous polling enterprise. His clients include Reuters, NBC News, MSNBC, C-SPAN, The New York Post, Gannett News Service, as well as IBM, MetLife, and Microsoft, and his writing has appeared in The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. He recently published a book he believes offers us what he describes as a new plate tectonics of American society resulting from polling questions that he says go, quote, under the surface and, quote, hit the heart. His book is called The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And John Zogby joins us for this forum hour. And welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Well, before we begin talking about your book and about polling and lots of questions, particularly about the methodology of polling and all that, there's a new Washington Post ABC News poll that came out today. Reuters, in fact, one of your clients brought it out, that says that the surge after the Republican convention has put John McCain, well, neck and neck with Barack Obama, but particularly the demographics of white women, he's taken a huge lead because of the convention. And, of course, Obama's campaign manager says, your polling is wrong. So what do you think?
I think the truth is somewhere in between. I have to tell you that, yes, to some degree, white women have moved in McCain's direction. That is a typical bounce from a convention. Also, it's a typical bounce, I guess one would suspect, by appointing a white woman, a history-making white woman, as a nominee. But when I drill down a little deeper, which is, as I said, what I do, we looked at white independent women. And 1 week ago, 15% of that group told us that they were undecided. That was right after the Palin announcement, right after the Obama speech. In our last poll over this past weekend, it was now down to 7% of independent women who said that they were undecided. And almost all of that difference from the 15% to the 7% broke to Obama. So there's a little more going on here than one would appear from just this one headline here.
Well, this one headline says a 20-point reversal, which is really pretty significant and dramatic by any standards.
Yeah, and I don't get it, to be honest with you.
Well, we'll find out maybe what some of our listeners think about that and polling in the course of this hour. First, I thought we'd talk about your book, which focuses to a great extent on what you call first globals. These are young people between the ages of 18 and 29, and you did a lot of polling in Hamilton College and beyond and
yes.
Found out some pretty optimistic things. Here's the most forward-looking generation in American history. They're global-minded. They're the most colorblind, the most unaware of differences or not biased where gay and lesbians are concerned. But, of course, we keep hearing that this is also the most uninformed generation of all.
Well, yeah, I do point out that not necessarily the smartest age cohort. So, for example, they may not be able to find Darfur on the map. What makes them different than previous groups of 20-somethings is that they at least know that there is a Darfur on the map. So the planet is really their playing field. Let's start with some basics. 56% of this group, 18 to 29-year-olds, have a live passport. Most of them, overwhelmingly, have traveled abroad. But in addition to that, they are socially networked with people all over the world, and they share with people all over the world an affinity for global music, global sports, global fashion, a different playing field. So when I take a look at that large subset of 18 to 29-year-olds with passports, I find that this group is as likely to call themselves citizens of the planet Earth as they are to call themselves U.S. citizens. That's just so different from any other cohort that's out there. Secondly, 23% of this group tell us that they are, or that they expect, not hope or wish, but that they expect to live and work in an exotic capital at some point in their lives. Now, you mentioned the diversity, the multiculturalism, and so on. Obviously, this group is further away from segregation and more in tune with a multicultural planet and a multicultural United States than any other age cohort.
So, also, most Democrats, members of the Democratic Party, or identify with the Democratic Party, and more MoveOn.org people come from this age group, this demographic.
That's true. But by the same token, lest I portray a solely liberal or progressive group, it's not entirely so. You take the issue of abortion, this group is less likely to be pro-choice on all occasions or situations than, say, baby boomers are. And in fact, one of the things that's striking about this group is, despite the overt, I guess what you would say is progressive view or liberal view, this group tells us on an issue like abortion, give me the situation, and then I'll tell you whether it's legitimate or not legitimate. So the group has layers to it, which I find very intriguing.
Well, you also find there's optimism and much to be positive about in sort of the things you highlight. Yet isn't this supposed to be also the most materialistic and self-absorbed demographic of all?
Well, you know what? There are two, yes, the short answer. And the truth is, when it comes to age cohorts, there are two items that define an age cohort. One is the life cycle. 20-somethings are still 20-somethings. They're consumed with the self, consumed with consumption, consumed with personal relationships, friendships, career, and love, and so on. But the also historical era in which they develop helps to modify some things of the life cycle. And so this is a planetary age, and the age of the internet and cheap travel. And so what is developing now among typical 20-somethings is a worldview, much of which they will carry into their 30s, into their 40s, into their 50s. Just as, say, the greatest generation were 20-somethings when they went to war, but they carried with them duty and sacrifice and honor and patriotism and so on.
I know you got a plug in your book from Brokaw. You may have to convince him that perhaps his generation was not the greatest generation, because this is a very positive view. I'm wondering, though, it gets us. And we're talking, by the way, to John Zogby, who's head of the Zogby International Polling Firm and author of The Way We'll Be, the Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream, and find out more about what this means as you see it in terms of analysis of the American Dream. Interested, though, in the way the questions are phrased, many people are, with respect to polling and the whole, quote, science of polling. For example, you asked a question as about imperialist powers acting on their own regardless of the rest of the world, and you saw the huge spread as far as this group, much bigger than, say, libertarians, progressives, New York Times readers, despite the fact that this is also a woefully uninformed demographic, or at least so we hear. What about the way questions are phrased? For example, you were criticized, Zogby was criticized, during the polling of the last Democratic primaries and all, was saying, leading with the Clinton administration was corrupt, or words to that effect.
Oh, I remember that one.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of, we'll talk about some more, perhaps, criticism, because I'd like you to respond to some of this, but certainly the way you phrase a question, when you talk about lead with American as imperialist power, the Clinton administration being corrupt, is going to certainly have a tremendous effect on how the person's going to respond.
Yeah, you know, a very good question. And, you know, the reality, I think, of my business is that not every question has to be neutered to get a response. I mean, basically what you want to do is you want people to, as well, sometimes they have to be neutered and 100% objective. Other times you want to know what kinds of values are tweaked when you offer them questions, what they're likely to respond to, what's likely to press their buttons, what they're likely to recoil from. And so in this instance, the Clinton administration is corrupt. That was a client, and it was indeed a conservative client. I have to tell you, you should see the form that the question came in to us. So we haggled back and forth till we got to this final wording. And then I personally signed off on the question, the details of which I honestly don't remember. But I thought that the way we worded it, at least it offered a premise, and then we offered an agree or disagree. And I thought that it was as legitimate a question as if we just asked another question, which we have in the past, simply about the Clinton administration. We got a chance then to see how did opinions move when you offered a different description. And so I stand by it. I don't like the way that the group that sponsored the question marketed the question, but I also am anxious to point out that the group got soundly beaten up, and probably deservedly so, for leading their release with that question and its results, and trying to market it as something that it wasn't. For me,
this group remains unnamed.
No.
You said
Judicial Watch. Judicial Watch.
Right.
Yeah. Remember, we do a lot of things for a lot of people.
Well, you kind of got your brand name. You won your chops back in 1996 and became a powerhouse polling institution by making picks of the Clinton administration. But then, we'll fast forward quickly to 2006, well, actually even before that, on Election Day, when the Zogby poll predicted on Election Day that John Kerry would win by 311 electoral votes. That kind of hurt and sank some of your credibility, because to some extent this is a game about saying, in fact, you were saying Virginia was too close to call and Bush won there by close to 10%. This is an enterprise where you have to be right, isn't it? You can't. I mean, say you're like a meteorologist, but if you're wrong on the big things, it stays with people.
Well, and I think also if you have a brand name that most people can identify, it didn't help. But you know, I don't come to San Francisco today with hat in hand. You know, we do very, very well and still have a very good brand name. But yeah, let me answer that. First of all, I'm a pollster, and I learned even more that I'm a pollster and not a predictor. There was a bit of hubris that was involved. My polls were very dead on in 2004. I had George W. Bush leading and came within actually a point and a half of the final result. The historian in me and the analyst looked at the other questions and said, incumbents don't win with these kinds of numbers. I believe Kerry will win. Where I made my mistake was that I made a projection late in the afternoon on Election Day of 2004, taking the exit poll results, the first round of exit poll results. And you used to be able, you know, to go to the bank with those exit poll results that came out at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And basically, I guess you could say I went to Countrywide.
The exit polls, I think your phrase was, your quote was, they were uncharacteristically inaccurate in 2004. And then political analyst, who I know you know personally, Larry Sabato, said, they've always been inaccurate. What's the difference? You know?
Yeah, well, they're a whole lot more inaccurate during a close election than you really get to feel how inaccurate they are, whereas you don't feel it with a Nixon McGovern kind of thing. You know, the exit polls can say Nixon's winning by 20 and he ends up winning by 32. Who cares? But bottom line is, it was hubris on my part. My polls were right. My prediction was wrong. And so people are trying to get me to predict this presidential race. I don't do that anymore. I just poll. I'm a humble pollster.
A humble
pollster? Plying my craft.
Is that oxymoronic? That's not oxymoronic, then. Well, I was looking at the record. There are some of these things that stand out. You picked Walter Mondale over Norm Coleman, Ted Strickland over Wayne Allard, Max Cleland over Saxby Chambliss. In other words, you know, there are a lot of misses.
Oh, there are misses. But, you know, understand, let's have proper expectations here. Those were all very close races, and they were close races right up until the very end, you know, and we polled into Sunday and into Monday. But you know, when you have 8, 10, 12, in case of the New Hampshire primary this year, 18% of the voters who actually vote say, I made up my minds today. All we can do really is just continue to take our snapshots and try to identify the trends. And so we don't predict the future. What we do is try and establish maybe some guideposts as to what might happen. But in every instance, those were close races, and we identified them, you know, as close races.
And we're talking again, if you've just joined us, with John Zogby. His book is called The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And you know, we'll get into the book because there's much here to get into. I want to just, I had mentioned 2006 because I was thinking about the fact that you did something that was unprecedented and many people gave you a lot of praise for. That is, you talked to the troops and you said, do you want to stay or do you want to leave? Is it time to withdraw or is it indeed a mission that ought to be accomplished? And Tim Kaine said, and he used the phrasing, unforgivable bias in this poll, because he said that the way the questions were at, the way the question was phrased, again, and this has to do with the way pollsters phrase questions, it seems to me, it was stay or go. There was no nuance to the question. There was no opportunity for nuance.
No. Tim Kaine, the governor?
Yeah.
No. He didn't read the questions. Maybe that's why he wasn't chosen. We, as I recall, we're going way back, but no, we offered, when do you think it is appropriate for American troops to leave? Within the next 6 months, within the next year, within the next year to 2 years? There were choices all the way down to it's not appropriate for troops to leave until the job is done. No, I thought we were extremely careful on our questions.
You saw it as pretty much as an either-or, but...
it was not an either-or.
How do you account for the fact that now you got 20% of people who use cell phones only use cell phones, and with this increasing technology, it gets harder and harder to poll people, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To really poll accurately, particularly that younger demographic who are reliant on cell phones?
It's getting harder and harder to poll people. It's not getting harder and harder to poll accurately yet. So this is a complex discussion that I'll try to boil down. Right now, studies that we've done and that Pew Research has done at least indicate, at least for now, no difference politically, either behaviorally or attitudinally, between cell phone only young people and landline access young people. So for now...
How do you know that if you can't get the kids on the cell phone?
Oh, no, you know, this is testing cell phones. No, you can get them on cell phones. However, will we get to the point where there will be a difference and we get an a significant underrepresentation of young people with cell phones? And the answer is yes. I don't believe we are there yet. As a policy, Zogby International will not call people on cell phones because, you know, a typical poll is 40, 50, 60 questions. And that is truly a major invasion into people's lives. That's why we've been segueing over the last 10 years from landline telephone, which is half of what we do domestically here, to online interactive polling, where we have a very large database of a representative sampling of the American people.
And there's some self-selection, though, when you do interactive polling. There's no requirement to participate, so
no.
It's self-selected.
It's self-selected, but so it's self-selected when people decide to answer the telephone these days. When I started in this business, we got a 65% response rate in 1984. We have about a 16-18% average response rate, and much lower in metropolitan areas.
So should people be too much besieged by telecommunicators of one sort or another, you think?
I go back to the days, Michael, when I first started, when, I've got a long-distance call. It's important. Odds are it's a long-distance call, but it's not very important anymore. And so it doesn't help the business.
Talking again with John Zogby. And what is important is this book of his, The Way Will Be. We're going to talk about polling, and certainly many of you may want to talk with him just about methodologies of polling and questions and concerns you have about polling. But what he says essentially in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, the BS era is over. We've gone from being a nation of excess to one of being a nation of limits, maybe perhaps one could say because the economy has compelled it. But because of this, again, demographic group that you're focusing on. That's the change of the American dream.
Essentially, and you know what it is these are trends that were well established in the 1990s, and then just continue to move on into this millennium. And so all of these trends predate the $4 and $3.50 a gallon gasoline. I think the high price of fuel dramatizes the trend, but the trends were in place. We are coming to grips with limits, and I see it in a number of respects, one of which is tracking how people view the American dream. We now have more people saying that the American dream is about some sort of personal fulfillment, spiritual fulfillment, as opposed to any one of the material definitions, you know, a house of the suburbs, rag to riches, succeeding in business and or profession.
So, excuse me, you've got the most interdirected generation, but also the most materialistic generation.
Well, it's not all 18 to 29-year-olds. But, yeah, in terms of 18 to 29-year-olds, remember, they're still 18 to 29-year-olds and consumed with the self, but consumed with the self with a planetary view and a view in terms of planetary problems that include the environment. They have a head start then into their 30s and 40s with this worldview. But no, the book is not entirely about 18 to 29-year-olds. It's about...
I didn't mean to make... it's about a real transformation.
But let me tell you what this transformation of the American dream, learning to live within limits, what the source of it is. And briefly, one group of people are the growing number of Americans, now 27% of all adults, who work at a job that pays less than a previous job. This is a need to redefine the American dream that has been imposed upon people. In other words, making lemonade out of the lemons that have been dealt them. This is a group that has less to spend, wants to make sure that they spend it as effectively and efficiently as they can, and also who realize that in many ways they're not going to get that material success that has been the traditional American dream. On the other end of the spectrum, fewer in number but still growing are those who have succeeded and done quite well materially, but who are asking themselves, is this what it's all about, and is this how I really want to be defined? And so there is an active and burgeoning simplification movement. And then in the middle, demographically, it's, dare I say, people in our age group, from the mid-40s to the mid-60s, we are the first age cohort that will have 1 million of us reach the age of 100. Translated, as we contemplate retirement or retire, we are coming to the realization that for many of us, we'll have 25 to 35 more years of healthy living ahead of us. Now what do I do? That's a long time.
Big questions. And again, we're talking to John Zogby not only about what he sees as transformation of the American dream, but also about polling and the whole world of polling. And you are welcome to join us if you have a question for John Zogby or if you have something you'd like to bring into the discussion here. We welcome your calls. And that toll-free number that's available to you now is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere, and whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, join the program by calling 866-733-6786 or sending an email to forum@kqed.org. And you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with pollster John Zogby, who is the author of a new book called The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And he'll be at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco tonight at 6:30 at Herbst Theater over at 401 Van Ness Avenue. And something actually before we go to callers and find out what our listeners have to say or ask, out of this work that you've done that we're talking about, there's the first great global corporate citizen symposium. I mean, IBM got into this. It's kind of exciting for you, I imagine.
Yeah, it really is. To be able to participate and to be able to help recruit these global citizens, you know, to these leadership forums, one in the United States in Washington and the other last May in London. And yeah, essentially, you know, IBM has defined for itself the globally integrated enterprise, which, different from just simply a multinational, is a company where its workers are mobile worldwide, and that they can, IBM can create nerve centers in places where it makes the most sense to have those nerve centers, and a lot of it based on where they can get people to come to and travel to. And here you have a large group in this country, but also a large group in Europe, and to varying degrees, first global citizens, really, and that's the next book I'm working on, all over the world. So it's a very exciting time.
Let's go to your calls, and Judy, you're up first. Good morning.
Hi. I'm trying to formulate this question, but how can you poll and know what folks think when people are 18 months you're looking at two people, and then you're looking at 18 days for another person? How can you be assured? Does it make any sense?
I'm not sure I get that. Are you talking about the candidates?
Yeah, I'm talking about the candidates. We had two candidates that we looked at for 18 months.
Yeah.
And then, as I understand it, the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party, she's only been on for 18 days, and they're only going to let her out, if you will, for one viewing. And how can you poll that?
Boy, that sounds so much like a wake, doesn't it? The viewing.
I know
what you're getting at. It's really no different this year than it has been in the past. I will say this: the vice presidential nominee in either party is good for 72 hours. Maybe let's make it 96 hours. Draws an awful lot of attention. Either helps or hurts, generally helps. In this case, both of them helped their candidates. And then from there on in, it's the blue highways and the back roads for the VPs. Starting really today, yesterday, this election is about Obama versus McCain. Sarah Palin did her work last week. To some degree, Joe Biden did his work the week before. And from here on in, unless there's breaking news about Palin and Biden that we don't know about, it's really about the presidential candidates.
It always has been. And in fact, and thank you, Judy, for the call. Unless something, you know, like an Eagleton or something goes wrong,
exactly,
along those lines, it won't affect the race as far as running mate. And yet you have this recent poll that shows that, I don't know how much stock you put in it or others do, that Sarah Palin's addition to the McCain campaign has offered a great huge boost to McCain where white women are concerned. What's of interest here, though, in my mind, is she mentioned the one viewing, like you said, like a wake. Joe Biden and Sarah Palin are going to be in a debate, and
yep,
she may, you know, be massacred by him because he's had 36 years experience in the Senate and is head of the Foreign Affairs. To get into Foreign Affairs, she's probably a neophyte. On the other hand, Joe Biden has been known to shoot off his mouth and have logorrhea and problems, you know, talking too much, and he may make a total idiot of himself. And so that could really make a difference.
It could, generally 1%. Now, we've learned in the last two presidential elections that 1%, you know, can loom very, very large. If you extrapolate that not only nationally, but in 17, 18 states that right now are too close to call, that can tip one way or another. Frankly, I think Joe Biden is in a very, very difficult situation because if he comes out with loaded guns,
they'll say sexist.
He's a bully and a sexist.
Yeah.
And if he comes out quiet, boy, she shut him down, didn't she? It's not a good position to be in. He may want to get a coughing fit.
I'm going to go to Karen next. Hi, Karen. Join us.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Hi.
I thought that was a very interesting point that you were just making about the VPs going back into the background. I hope that's true. I guess my fear is the media is going crazy with her, much like they did, I guess, with Obama. But I can't wait for her to fade into the background. My comment was just about what you had said earlier about redefining success. My husband and I are both in our late 20s, and we spent our early 20s trying to figure out how we were going to live up to my parents' material wealth and how we were going to make them proud and make all this money. And we quickly realized in the last year or so that that just was not ever going to happen. So we had to redefine how we were going to be successful as a couple, as people, as parents. And it was put on us. But it's been a wonderful gift, and one of those redefinitions is staying home with our children and trying to create a solid family unit instead of being at work 10 hours a day, you know, to slave away for material things. So I really related to what you just said because it was very much an epiphany for both of us.
Well, I think you fall into pretty much what Mr. Zogby has discovered in a lot of his polling.
Yeah, Karen, thank you for that. And let me just bless you by saying you're very fortunate to have made that decision and reached that epiphany at 28 as opposed to 68. No.
Okay.
Sorry. But
you did say you're like a priest.
I did now, didn't I? Yeah. Hey, thanks, Karen.
Karen, thank you for the call. And we'll go right to more of your calls. We'll go to Aaron next. Aaron, good morning.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Hi.
I had a quick question for Mr. Zogby there. I was wondering how much of these polls actually sway public opinion?
Yeah, good question. My challenge always is to bring me five people who have made up their minds because of what a Zogby poll or a Gallup poll have said. I usually find that people who feel that way, that the polls sway public opinion, are always talking about the great unwashed American out there. But, oh, not me and my friends. We're too sophisticated for that. I don't think it does in terms of an election. But we do have an impact. If somebody early on is trying to raise money for a race and a poll comes out and shows that candidate is behind 72-4, then sure, it's going to be very difficult for that candidate to go out and raise money. And public opinion or a poll has had an impact. In the closing days of a race.
Yeah, forgive me, but John McCain wasn't able to raise money because a lot of the polls showed him really lackluster and way behind. And then everything shifted.
And a rare kind of politician is John McCain, who is at his best when he puts the boxing gloves on and says, and on top of everything else, I don't have enough money because I'm running against this corrupt machine. Not everybody is that flexible. But that's the John McCain that everybody loved 8 years ago, and you see him coming back in, and that's why this is a horse race.
Things changed also when he went to see Jerry Falwell, I think.
But that was not the John McCain that everybody...
That's what I mean. Suddenly there was a different perception nationally even of McCain. I don't know what the poll showed on that, but it certainly
seemed didn't work for him.
Let's go to Matt next. Matt, welcome. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Question is for Mr. Zogby. I'm curious if you've done any polling in the Middle East that would give us insight into how the folks in the Arab street compare in terms of their dreams to those who are the subjects of your new book.
Thanks, Matt. I've done a lot of polling throughout the Arab world over the last 10 years. And essentially, just in terms of values, what we find basically is that Arabs want what everybody else wants.
Which means they want prosperity and peace.
Peace and prosperity and, an opportunity for their children and so on. Interestingly, I find that here in the United States, mainly in Washington, D.C., there is a misunderstanding of what Arabs want. Because we ask Arabs also about democracy and about reforms, and they tell us, yes, there are reforms we want. We want infrastructure. We want health care. We want good public education and so on. Lower on the list, and this includes women, are things that deal with direct democracy and with the rights of women and so on. They say they want rights for women. There are older Arabs that feel less that way. There are women who feel less that way. But we've got to really study this public opinion and find that we're just simply talking about a different culture with different emphases. But in terms of values, peace and prosperity and opportunity, those are universal values.
Speaking
of
a different
share.
Culture, you know, this whole idea of an Arab street has always struck me as kind of peculiar because you've got so many different cultures. You know, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Iraq are completely different culturally and in so many ways in terms of tradition and heritage and customs and mores, that to speak of the Arab street seems to me to be a kind of monolithic mistake.
It is, and in fact, and Matt certainly didn't mean anything by this, but even the term Arab street.
It's so widely used, it's become
habitual.
Yeah.
Problematic. But, yeah, there are varying cultures, but there is a pan-Arab. There is a pan-Arab culture that that people do identify with.
Talking to John Zogby, if you just joined us. By the way, you can join us by phone by calling in our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or sending an email. Let's go to some of your emails. Ann writes, my question is, do you have any current polls on the media and entertainment industry's role in the dumbing down of American culture and our collective intelligence? Talk about a change of the American dream. Are we becoming a nation of incurious lemmings?
Wow. I have to hire her to ask my questions. No. You know, look, I maybe it's because I've been doing this such a long time. Individuals can be ill-informed and, in fact, in many instances, unaware and ignorant. But something happens, and it's almost like a Rousseauian thing, when the people, 1,000 people speak together in a poll, or millions of people speak together in a vote, there is a wisdom that emerges that's larger than the sum of its parts. And so I'm not a great believer that the American people are dumb. I don't think they're dumber than they were. I think that essentially that there are people who are utilizing a lot of their smarts to survive, a lot of their smarts to get the kids to school on time and to keep a job. Not everybody can be a full-time Democrat or Republican, but their vote counts just as much as our vote, and I think it needs to be respected.
Let me respect some more of our emailers here. Just an opinion from Yvonne, who says, it seems to me that more often than not, those that complain about how a question was phrased simply don't like the answer. And here are some more questions for you.
Here, here, Yvonne.
Here's Shaker, who says, could you give us your thoughts on the polls of polls, which are used by news organizations such as CNN? It seems to me that the practice of averaging multiple polls ignores subtleties such as the way questions are asked, sample sizes, demographics of target groups, etc.
You're right, Shaker, and I don't have a problem so much with the poll of polls, so long as when you're averaging 5, 6, 7 polls, they're all within the same time frame. I have a problem. Say I want to take a look at what are the polls showing in Virginia, and I see the average, and I see one was done May 30th, and the other was done September 9th, and you can't average an issue that's so time sensitive as a horse race. But let me just warn the listeners that honestly, the least important and I think the least interesting thing that we do is ask who would you vote for if the election were going to be held today. That's an interesting snapshot. But what's much more important is to take a look at, as Shaker points out, all those subtleties and nuances. Where are independent women? Where are Walmart shoppers? Are there differences between NASCAR fans and not NASCAR fans? Where are the vectors pointing in terms of some of the subgroups out there? Are we seeing subtle shifts? Are we seeing some tectonic shifts? Let me just take one second here. One of the groups I talk about briefly in the book, Christian conservatives, young Christian conservatives who are telling their pastors and telling us pollsters, oh, yeah, I mean, we're anti-abortion and anti-gay marriage. We don't want to talk about that anymore. What we want to talk about global poverty. We want to talk about healthcare.
Global warming.
We want to talk about global warming, man's stewardship of God's earth. There are seemingly subtle but real tectonic shifts that are taking place out there. And that's the interesting part of what we do, not the horse race or the average of the horse race.
And yet you've compared finding out about politics and essentially polling about politics to finding out about use of foot ointment.
We have. It's the same sort of thing.
It doesn't sound very nuanced.
It doesn't. And, yet, you know, I had a question yesterday from someone who said, you work for corporations. And I don't trust corporations, so I'll never do a poll. And I said, well, you know, you don't want to go out there and say, I want to buy Crest toothpaste, because they don't care what I think. Remember, voters get to vote politically, you know, one day out of the year, but consumers get to vote every day. And is the wise corporation or the wise non-governmental organization or the wise whatever that actually cares what the public thinks?
Well, let's find out more about what our public thinks. So let me get through some of these emails and I'll get to your calls also. Mr. Zogby, how much influence do you feel media coverage really has on elections? It seems like voters are easily swayed by the story of the day, but perhaps voters aren't as affected by trendy media stories as it appears to many of us. And thanks from a fellow Utica native, Lisa.
Hey, Utica, how are you? You know something, Lisa, and everybody else? January 28th, 1998 was the second Declaration of American Independence. That's the day both Tim Russert and Sam Donaldson said the President of the United States will be out of the White House in 72 hours. And the American people had a different idea about that and kept Bill Clinton in as president. And so let's fast forward to this year. Saturday night before the New Hampshire primary, Sunday before the New Hampshire primary, who is going to write Hillary Clinton's obituary when she loses the New Hampshire primary? She was given up for dead. That's what all the pundits said, and as is their wont, the voters of New Hampshire had a completely different outcome.
But see, there's a dramatic example of why some people get very cynical about polls, because if indeed the Bradley effect was operating in New Hampshire, that is, if people were going in and voting because of race as opposed to what they told the pollsters, and indeed there's an argument to be made for it. I'm sure almost nobody wants to appear racist, so they will indeed conceal perhaps the fact that they may be racist and then go into the privacy of a voting booth and vote differently.
No,
that's what happened in New Hampshire.
No, it isn't. No, and my friend Andy Kohut, who wrote that in the New York Times, was basing it on zero evidence because he wasn't even polling. In New Hampshire, I was, and I know exactly what did happen, and I was one of the ones who got it way off. I'll tell you, number one, what happened is that Obama was so far ahead that a large number of independents flipped from the Democratic primary, as they can do, and voted for John McCain in the Republican primary. That was number one. And number two, the Hillary tearing up incident really congealed older women in New Hampshire, many of whom were undecided, and now saw her candidacy as historical destiny.
Granted, those are big factors, but how can you account for the race issue when, as I said, people won't give you a straight
answer?
Very
simple. No. They gave us straight answers. All of us polls, all of our polls, not only mine but others, we came in with Obama at 37-38%, which is exactly what he got. What was underestimated was the Hillary vote. In every state where we asked about race, there were people who told us, I'm not voting for Obama because he's black. But in every state, the ones we got right and the ones we got wrong, I shouldn't say in every, but in most instances, we got Obama's vote on the money. It was the underestimation of the last-minute undecided breaks towards Hillary. So I'm a firm believer. That's only one piece of evidence. There are others out there. Harold Ford in 2006, who actually got more votes on Election Day than the pre-election polls. I think the Bradley effect is gone.
Let me go to a couple more emails here, and then we'll go your calls on. Susan writes, listening to John Zogby, it strikes me as completely counterintuitive that phone polling is still reliable in politics when it's now only about 16% of people who take the poll on a landline or maybe even just answer the landline phone. I don't know anyone under 60 who routinely answers a call from an unknown number, and I suspect that if there are young people who do, they don't represent a very typical younger person. I think cell phone usage by the under 30 set has got to be a huge skewing factor in polling. Also, just a thought, the professional pollster has to be invested in the opinion poll that unreachable cell phones don't ruin the product, the political poll, but that they might someday. Maybe a bit of a credibility problem. And then another listener dovetails with this. Don says, how do you represent yourself on caller ID when you got all these cell phones?
It's an unknown number. Yeah. The difference between that long comment and me is that I have evidence and she has intuition. And I frankly, it is harder to do our job today than it's been, and there are changes. But I think we're making the adjustment to the changes, and I think the proof is in the pudding. Lots of news when we screw up a poll. There's no question about it. I know that. I've screwed up some polls, and I've gotten a lot of headlines for it. But maybe fewer headlines when all the times that we get them right. We got 19 of 24 right in the primaries, right on the money, and our track record over the years is good, suggesting that while the business may be difficult, it's not impossible.
Let me go to more calls, and we're going to go to Oakland next. Stephen, join us. Good morning. You're on forum.
I am wondering about the practice within the field and the ethics of the situation wherein a client might request a poll and not like the results, and so not release the results. Is it standard practice when a poll is done that the results will be made public, or can the client say, well, we'll keep rephrasing the question until we get a result I like and then release it?
Good question. First of all, understand that many clients do private polls for strategic planning purposes, for the communications department to determine messaging, for private reasons. Those who hire us to do polls for public release, there is, it's not a law, but there is the ethics of this business. If you're going to release a part of the poll, you've got to release the whole poll. And so when news media call us and say, so-and-so has just released a Zogby poll, and it says such and such, were there other questions, we are under obligation to release the other questions and the other answers.
Under your own internal obligation, not any legal requirement.
It is not a legal requirement, no.
And we thank you, Stephen, for the call. Actually, I think, is it correct to, I'm remembering in the primary, Joe Biden never really polled more than 1 or 2% in the Democratic primary?
You mean on the actual election day or in the polling?
During the polling when he was running for the presidential nomination.
Yeah, and in Iowa, there were times we'd get Biden at 3 or 4%, but no, by and large, it was a point or two.
Here's a listener who wants to know, are you hiring? Mm-hmm. But he also wants to know what your mix is of statisticians and social scientists on staff.
Okay, well, there are 70 full-time, peak-time people, and then we have 250, 280 in our call center. Our statisticians are 9 people, although we just did hire 3 more. So there's 12. In terms of bona fide social scientists who are full-time but doing a myriad of things, probably a dozen to 15 or so. Maybe more towards 15.
Samantha, let's get you on next. You're on forum. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. I think one of the exciting things about this election is that a lot of people are getting engaged who haven't been engaged before. And, you know, we heard reports after the primaries of huge, you know, unexpected turnouts and elections officials having to go get more ballots and things like that. And I feel like that's something that's not really reflected in a lot of the polling that's coming out, because it's typically polling likely voters. And that's something, you know, when they're raving about the bump that McCain Palin got, they're not talking about, you know, the fact that they're polling likely voters and that, you know, a lot of people are thinking there's going to be a huge bump from unlikely voters this election, and there's not really a lot of discussion about how that's going to play in, and I think it, you know, it gives kind of a benefit to McCain and Palin this time.
You know, that's a very good point. I don't think that's the case, but I will tell you, you know, starting very shortly, we will be polling every day, and we'll be able then to find out if there are unlikely voters today who are likely voters tomorrow. I believe that we're reaching them, and I also believe that this race really is at equilibrium. And I've always felt that it would be, simply because once the Republicans got a nominee and George W. Bush was kind of pushed aside, the Republican brand would just automatically go up a few points. I think, and I may have mentioned this before, that John McCain brings a different kind of Republican, one that appeals to the middle, which is something that Republicans haven't been too hot at doing.
That's his big selling job, isn't it? I mean, to make the public realize, I mean, the Democrats have tried to link him with the Bush administration because of his unpopularity and his low polls.
Which is exactly what I would do if I were them.
And indeed, at this point, McCain is saying, I'm different. You would have thought, watching the Republican National Convention, that it was almost the Democratic National Convention. It was so much about change.
It was, and it's going to be change, because his feet will be held to the fire if he's elected. But what Sarah Palin does is she offers McCain cover to be that independent. She's the red meat.
That's the role of traditionally of vice presidential candidates, to be the attack dogs, or sometimes, as some would have it, to even serve in the Oval Office in terms of powers, like Dick Cheney did, at least recently. Anyway, it's good to have you on, John.
Hey, it's a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
John Zagby will be at the World Affairs Council tonight, 6:30 at Herb Theater. And his book, again, is called The Way Will Be, The Zagby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. And we're transforming ourselves. In fact, speaking of transformation, we do every hour to hour. We're going to talk about Spore in the next hour, which is the most anticipated video game probably of all time. And you think, video games, what does that have to do with serious discourse? Well, this is a video game which has to do with creating life forms and learning about evolution. And it's really pretty fascinating stuff. That's the hour ahead. We're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated in the evening. I want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.